y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton and Show. Here from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network every weekday. Our first guest up on the show today is Murtaza Hussein, and he is co-author with Razan Galani, of this great article at The Intercept, Christie's Conspiracy, the real story behind the Fort Dix 5 terror plot. And of course, Christie is a reference to the current governor of New Jersey, who's fixing to announce that he's running for president. He already is, really, running for president. And it turns out this case, he kind of rode on the back of it in order to get into the governor's office in the first place, it sounds like. I guess we don't know what would have been otherwise, but certainly made his bones on it. So that's very interesting. We all knew from the very beginning that the Fort Dix pizza plot was a giant hoax. Once you say informant, then we all know it was a giant sting operation. And the same thing that the FBI has done scores of times, as covered especially by Trevor Aronson, formerly of Mother Jones and now also at The Intercept in his book, The Terror Factory. But this is the best deep dive into the Fort Dix pizza plot that I've ever heard of. Very happy to see what you've done here. And I guess, first of all, I'll welcome you to the show and then ask you to please pronounce your co-author's name correctly for us. Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And the co-author is Razan Galani.
All right, great. I guess I was kind of surprised to find out about this when it not only was this an entrapment job, but that actually it was only a half-successful entrapment job at best when it comes to the actual entrapping, and yet the people that the government failed to entrap, they were all sentenced to, was it life in prison anyway?
Yeah, life in prison. So, essentially, there were five guys who they were seeking to entrap. One guy, they basically got 22-year-old Mohammed Schnur. He went along with the informant, who was about, 36, 37, quite a bit older than him. There was another guy, Sardar Tatar, who was actually trying, he called the police and told him that I think this guy, the informant, who he didn't know was an informant, was a terrorist. He tried reporting him to the police a number of times, tried recording him. But somehow he also ended up getting entrapped because he gave him a map that he'd asked for. And he didn't get life, he got 30 years. And then the guys we focus on in the story, the Duca brothers, they didn't know about any plot or any map or anything at all. They didn't know about it, but due to their relation to Mohammed Schnur, he was a brother-in-law of one of these guys, and they ended up being charged with the crime anyways. And at trial, the prosecution and even the judge conceded, well, there's not any evidence these guys actually knew about the plot per se. There's no direct evidence of the words they used. But under conspiracy law in the United States, you don't have to prove that direct evidence. All you have to do is prove that they seem to have potentially known about it, although there was no evidence that they did.
All right, now, so rewind a second to the guy who you say that when the FBI sent the informant to entrap him, the first thing he did was call the cops and say, hey, some guy's trying to get me to do a terrorist attack. And then what happened after that? Nothing?
Well, he had been trying to talk to this guy, saying, we should do something, blah, 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 blah. And this guy, essentially, he called the police. He was a police officer who knew him. He used to come into 7-Eleven every morning to have coffee. He told him, look, I think this guy's a terrorist. And I've been recording him on my cell phone, some of the things he's been saying. And this guy, Sardar, actually wanted to be a police officer himself. He'd actually asked that police officer several times if he can go along on ride-alongs with him and so forth. And the police officer said, well, I'll put you in touch with someone from the FBI. And then three weeks passed, and no one from the FBI contacted him. And finally, when someone did, they came by and they told him not to worry about it. And he tried showing them the recordings and said, well, I don't know what this is, and just forget about it. And then the same FBI agent was the guy who ended up coming to arrest him a few months later when this plot was uncovered, quote unquote. And what's even more egregious is that the prosecution at trial said that these guys had gone on a trip to the Poconos to train, and they go on an annual Poconos vacation. This is how they first aroused the suspicion. And Sadar actually invited the police officer along on one of these trips, and he declined to go because he said, look, I think I want you to check out this guy. And so, you know, he tried everything he could to actually report the informant to the police.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, and now, yeah, I'm sorry I should have had a better structure to my questions here. Let's go back to that, the trip to the Poconos, because that's where the FBI first got interested in these guys, right?
Yeah, exactly. So these guys had gone to the Poconos mountains for a vacation in December of 2006, and they went there and they made a home video of themselves, like, climbing trees and, like, riding horses and skiing, and they went to a shooting range as well. And so then they went to drop off this video to the shooting range and everything else to Circuit City because they thought it was just an annual vacation video, which they always take. And the Circuit City saw these, like, Muslim guys, you know, at the shooting range and doing this other stuff, skiing and so forth. And he got alarmed and he called the police. And then the police initiated this investigation, which took about almost 2 years. Try to infiltrate them with informants and so forth, and then it resulted in these arrests. But it all was triggered by this dropping off of the home video at Circuit City.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things there is, you know, you can figure that they thought, well, geez, you know, maybe the police ought to check this out, but it probably never occurred to the people who called 911, you know, the rat at Circuit City, probably never occurred to them that, well, if they're innocent people, the FBI will entrap them and frame them for a crime and then lock them in prison for the rest of their lives, and it'll be all our fault. They never considered that for a minute. They just wanted to make sure everything's okay. If you see something, say something, and all these kinds of things, do the right thing, when in fact they're the worst criminals, the people at Circuit City who violated the privacy of their customer and then turned the most violent force on the planet against them.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. And then there were actually a lot of stories about the Circuit City guy afterwards, kind of like lauding his heroism and so forth. And I mean, look, if someone...
Well, people might remember, too, like, that's probably the most memorable part about this case, other than the so-called, you know, pizza part. It was going to be an attack on soldiers from a pizza man or whatever, was that, you know, this hero at Circuit City, you know, found the evidence and it didn't get by him. Like you're saying, yeah, he was lauded and his behavior was lauded. And that the tape showed terrorist training was absolutely taken for granted. If people remember it at all, they remember, oh, yeah, the terrorist training tape. But like you're saying, no, it's just some guys camping in the woods and behaving as men behave, shooting rifles at targets and such.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the most odious things was at trial, there was, like, a pretty long video, like an hour-long video they made to share with everybody. And they were doing these other things, like skiing, just, like, goofing off and in the Poconos, but at trial, the prosecution only showed a little clip of them at the gun range to give the impression that this actually was like a training video, like an Al-Qaeda video, where they just had recorded their, like, tactics with the guns. So, yeah, it was just awful, awful. And that guy, he turned in, he was just doing what people, you know, see something, say something. He was going along with what society was sort of instructing him. But, I mean, the FBI, after realizing that there wasn't actually a plot or anything, the fact that they kept, you know, pouring all this money and time into still manufacturing one is just unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, you know, they got to pretend that there's a terrorist threat or else they might have to get real jobs, and so they don't want to do that.
Right.
Apparently. All right, so now the guy that you say who originally went to his friend the cop and said and to the FBI and said, help, one of your informants is trying to entrap me, so to speak, that he eventually, I think as you put it in here, inexplicably turned around and gave a map to a guy, one of the informants, who had he already pegged that guy as an informant, or this is the other informant that he gave the map to. But he already could have or should have known that they were going to use it for ill. Is that right or not?
Yeah, that was the whole, in my interpretation of the events, the informant, like from reading the transcripts again, the informant was coming to him all the time and badgering him for this nap. Like, yeah. give me the nap.
All right, hold it right there. I'm sorry, we're at the break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. Firstlook.org/The Intercept. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept, Christie's Conspiracy, Terror Plot of the Fort Dix Five. Obvious bogus entrapment job from the very beginning. It's kind of amazing to me how the FBI doesn't mind admitting, yeah, an informant was in on it the whole time. The public was never actually in danger. Yeah, in other words, you framed some guy. And we're not impressed, but they just happily admit that every single time. And so, you know, it's not too hard. But here, these guys have done a real, deep dive here, Murtaza and his co-author on what really happened here. And I'm sorry, we got interrupted by the break because I asked you a question right before the break because I wasn't looking at the clock. And it was, the passing of the map. The guy who felt like someone was trying to pressure him into doing something wrong and was so worried about it that he even went to the FBI over it. Eventually gave in to the rat and gave him a map. And then, is that the basis of this guy's entire conviction then? Or did I'm sorry. The important question is, what did he know about what that map might be used for at the time? That kind of thing. Cause even if he's entrapped, still, you don't give a map to a guy who says he's going to use it to kill people, probably, right?
I think that, what happened was, like, from the transcript, he was being badgered about it all the time. He's like, even when he's giving the map, like, I don't think you should do anything with this. And then, but I think what really got him in trouble is that the FBI, this was in between the 3 weeks from when he told a police officer, when the FBI actually showed up, that's when he gave him the map. And the FBI officer, when he came, he asked him, he told him about the map. He said, so did you give him the map? And then he got scared and he said, well, no. So I guess he kind of bumbled himself into the plot, but it was a very haphazard way. So he was the guy where you could say, well, maybe the informant, in this really messed up way, succeeded in entrapping him. But he also did try to recruit him. What was different about the Duker brothers is that they never...
Well, wait, on this guy, though, did this guy do anything other than hand over the map, or that's it? And then, I mean, and lie to the FBI about it?
No, that was it.
That was it. Okay, and then, I'm sorry, about the brothers.
And the brothers, they never even knew about the map. They never knew about the plot. No one ever raised it with them over hundreds of hours of surveillance. The other co-defendants, the guy who was really going along with the informant, Muhammad Shnur, he wrote a letter to the judge saying that, you know, I made these false statements about the brothers. They didn't actually know anything. The informant himself, who we tracked down and talked to in the piece, he also told us that the brothers never said anything to him about any plot and they didn't know about it. So, like, it's pretty resounding that these guys had nothing to do with anything, and yet they're sitting in ADX Supermax, a few of them, in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day, serving life sentences.
And so, okay, so one entrapped guy, one guy who was under the influence of an informant, had bragged to that informant that, oh yeah, the brothers, I got them all lined up, they're cool, but that's all they ever had was that hearsay and no actual evidence that the brothers even knew about it. And then I think, as you say in here, make sure I'm right about that, but also... you have them quoted from, I guess, the surveillance in jail or something, where the brothers are saying to the other guy, you told them what about us? And it rings very believable.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy, when they're yelling at him, he pretended to like be asleep because he's kind of embarrassed that he'd like done all this. So, yeah, that's basically the gist of what they had, was this statement of Muhammad Shnur, which he later recanted. And then basically they're like, conspiracy law is such a, you know, a dangerous sort of law, because all they have to do is prove state of mind with these guys at the time to try to prove it. There's no evidence. Let's just try to prove their state of mind. So they went through the Google history or the YouTube clips and tried to say that, hey, by the way, these guys actually are terrorists, blah, blah, blah. But they had never had any evidence. And anything they could produce was, like, you know, countervailed by a million other things. Mm-hmm. So it was just, like, an unbelievably shocking prosecution.
And I guess they must have made a big deal about the guns to the jury, right? They're like, oh, no, a foreigner with a gun. But they just basically they got him on a gun control possession charge for having a gun without first having their whatever level of green card or citizenship status. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So another part of conspiracy law is you have to prove that someone took one overt act towards the conspiracy. So they said that buying the guns from the informant was that overt act. But, you know, actually in the video, which we have of the, like, the gun deal happening, you can hear them saying, oh, this is great. Now we don't have to wait in line at the Poconos the next time we go. Because whenever they go to the Poconos, they have to wait in the line for people who rent guns. So the whole time they thought that they were doing this. And actually the informant, he tried to tell, like, when he offered them some guns, he said his friend at a gun store was selling at a cheap price. He offered them RPGs and, like, heavy machine guns and the type of things you'd use if you wanted to carry out a terrorist attack. And the guy got very alarmed. He's like, I don't want any of this. Like, he's like, everything was, like, okay. Like, I'm okay with the other normal stuff. So, like, well, what's up with this? If there's something going on, please tell me. And he said, no, nothing's going on. It's fine. So he actually declined the offer of these really hardcore weapons because he thought he was using them to go to the Poconos.
Yeah. Yeah, no, imagine. It's just like in the mind of every cop in America, apparently, where there's 300 million privately owned firearms. If anybody's holding a gun, they must be trying to kill you with it, so kill them. You just, you know, project whatever fear you want onto somebody holding a gun, even though this is America, the land of the gun, where everybody has a gun, and most people don't mean any harm by it whatsoever. But anyway, it makes for a great scary story for a bunch of terrified jurors, I guess. But now, so this guy, Schnur, he was the idiot dumb enough to get all the way entrapped into this thing. How entrapped did he get? He really was going along with these informants into planning to go to Fort Dix and massacre American soldiers on their base. Is that even true at all?
You know, one thing about Schnur is, like, he's kind of responsible for everyone being in jail. But whenever you talk to the Duca brothers, they refuse, even the family, they won't say anything bad about them because it says, yeah, he did do it, but, like, he was, like, we all knew him. He was like a child. Like, his behavior was so childish. He was always trying to be tough and impress us. We were from Brooklyn, and he was a younger guy, and he thought that he just wanted to be cool in front of us. So this older informant who was almost 40, he starts talking to this guy who's 22 and sort of gassing him up and telling him, you know, you should be doing stuff and what's wrong with you, blah, blah. And so he was trying to be tough and going along with him.
Should be doing stuff about what?
Like the wars and the gang revenge, or like really like the harebrained kind of plots, like talking about it amongst themselves. And he was, so he did go along with it. He kind of admitted that he went along with the informant. He successfully was entrapped by him. But the thing is, like, before the informant came, nothing was even going on, even with him. The one guy who, like, seemed to be, like, receptive to it. Mm-hmm. And he was just kind of dumb. Like, you know, if you hadn't introduced this grown man into his life and was trying to influence him this way, even with him, nothing would have happened.
Right.
So, I mean, just even his case, like, we didn't talk about him as much in terms of the problems of the prosecution, but it clearly is. Like the FBI's behavior, even with him, is insane.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's an important point. I mean, it's just so outrageous that these three brothers who, for, you know, are the best example where, you know, the feds apparently just completely failed to entrap them into doing anything but buying a gun without a license, which, what the hell is this, Germany or something? North Korea, where you have to have a license to buy a gun? Not to carry one out in public, God forbid, but to own one. Oh, got them on an unlicensed firearm charge, and then try to spin that into terrorism. And then, as you're saying, they're in the Supermax with Ted Kaczynski, with Ramzi Youssef.
Yeah, it's like two of the guys are in the Supermax, and it's like the worst conditions possible. Like, yeah. You know, we get one 15-minute phone call a month. They're sitting in a box 23 hours a day. Even the 1 hour they get out, it's not like, you know, your recreation hour is basically you get to stand outside in a cage, which is the same size as your cell. So, unbelievable. Torture.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it's really important, as you point out, about how impressionable the one kid was who then implicated everybody else, because that's something that we see over and over again, too, where the informant just, that's the qualification, right? They don't even find somebody who's really upset about foreign policy necessarily. or really into Salafism or something like that. They just find who's the dumbest kid down at the Islamic bookstore that they can manipulate. And as you say, this guy, all he ever wanted to do was get approval from people who are a little bit older than him. He's a very impressionable young kid, always trying to act tough and whatever. He's the perfect mark for a FBI con artist, basically.
Yeah, exactly. He was a absolute perfect mark, and, you know, it worked, and he went along with it, and not only did he go along with it, he got put on all his friends, too, and he got them all sent to jail for life. So, he's doing life, too, and, it's awful.
Yeah, well, and remember, everybody, how much mileage the national security state got out of this one. Oh, my God, a terrorist plot to attack our heroic soldiers at Fort Dix. They were going to use the pizza man's knowledge of the place to kill them all. And boy, did people eat that up, and especially in mainstream media, just repeat that like another 9/11 had been thwarted by our FBI heroes, when, of course, it's never the case. And if it was a real 9/11, they let it happen, right? Like Boston. All right. Hey, thanks so much for your time, Murtaza. Great work here. Murtaza Hussein, everybody.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.